This is The Book and the Spade, a report on the latest discoveries and developments in biblical archaeology. Here's your host, Gordon Govier.
Museums are one place you can go to see many of the types of artifacts that we talk about on The Book and the Spade and make an actual physical connection to the people and places of the biblical world. In previous programs, we visited the Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C., for instance, where they have an entire room that's curated by the Israel Antiquities Authority. This past year, I've had several opportunities to visit the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford, England. It's the oldest public museum in England and fourth oldest in the world. The top three are all in Italy. And it's the world's first university museum. Through a friend, I met James Gregg, who lives in Oxford and offers a tour called The Bible in the Ashmolean. So I've invited him onto the program today. Welcome, James.
Welcome. Nice to see you. Nice to meet you.
Did you grow up in Oxford going to the Ashmolean?
That's a good question. Actually, no, I grew up elsewhere. But my father was a student in Oxford and was converted in his first year at Worcester College, Oxford. So although he's now passed away, it's a special place for me. And I was very glad when I was relocated to Oxford because of my job.
The museum was founded in 1683 when Elias Ashmole gave a cabinet of curiosities to the University of Oxford in 1677. A couple of the items I saw particularly relating to biblical archaeology, one was the Sumerian King List Prism. It's also known as the Weld Blundell Prism, and that goes back to about 1800 BC in the biblical chronology, about the time of Abraham. This is a clay cuneiform inscribed prism found in 1922 in an expedition at Larsa in modern-day Iraq by the British archaeologist Herbert Weld Blundell. Four sides, they're inscribed in the Sumerian language with a list of Sumerian kings. Each side contains the text in two columns. It's considered the most complete of the Sumerian king list, so there are several others, about 25 more or less different fragments. The Sumerians were the earliest known civilization in Mesopotamia. This list goes back to before the flood, when kings were recorded with extremely long reigns. And there's a famous line, after the flood swept over and kingship had descended from heaven. So that's just one example of something that can be found in the Ashmolean. There's a lot of other things that connect us to the biblical world.
It's prominently located in the room that deals with the Old Testament world and period. It does list kings from before and after the flood. And it seems as though there's an assumption that people knew what was being written about. As you say, the lengths of the reigns of some of these kings are a little bit hard to believe. If you find, you know, Methuselah to have lived a long time, it's nothing compared to some of these kings who it's claimed lived for tens of thousands of years and reigned for this long. It kind of puts the long ages in Genesis into some perspective and slightly more credible.
And it assumes that in this world of Mesopotamia back around the time of Abraham, everybody knew about a flood.
Correct. Yeah, everyone knew about the flood. The purpose is more to show that, I guess, that the current kings at the time this was made are legitimate and have good pedigree, and they can trace their history all the way back. And I guess that was a lot of the purpose of genealogies at the time, and even when we get through to the New Testament.
Another thing I noticed right at the entrance of the museum was this carved gypsum slab that depicted sort of a bird-headed spirit that was excavated back around 1845 to 1850 from the palace of Ashurnasirpal II at Nimrud by Sir Austin Henry Layard. He sent it to Oxford in April of 1850 as thanks for an honorary degree, and they described the journey. It went down the Tigris River on a raft to Basra, from there to Bombay, and then around the Horn of Africa, and arrived in Oxford in January of 1852. Almost 2 years later. So Ashurnasirpal II was not mentioned in the Bible, but he was the father of Shalmaneser III, who famously received tribute from Jehu, the king of Israel, which is depicted in the British Museum in London.
The item in the British Museum is a beautifully carved black obelisk. And of course, because of the prohibition on making carved images under the Ten Commandments, it's really unusual for us to have a depiction of a prominent Israelite figure at all. And so we're only going to get it really from a carving done by a non-Jewish person, i.e. an Assyrian. But yeah, his father, Ashurnasirpal, in my mind, it some of these names are quite hard to remember, but I think of him as being the nasty one. So it sounds a bit like Ashurnasirpal, because he was particularly cruel. Yeah, Nimrod was excavated by Layard, who's an extraordinary Englishman who was on his way to tea plantations in Sri Lanka, or Ceylon as it was then called. He got interrupted on the way and started dabbling in archaeology, but we owe him a great debt because of the things that he uncovered. And there were various disputes between him and the British Navy, who didn't like being used as a pack horses to transfer antiquities. They thought that their boats had more important uses than to be transporting these old things. But the particular slab you're talking about, it is impressive because it's higher than the height of a man. And these carvings would originally have been painted. They'd have been quite vivid colors in the palaces. Images like this would definitely be designed to impress and intimidate, whether you were a subject of King Ashurnasirpal or whether you were a visiting dignitary, you'd be impressed by the size of these. This particular figure has to do with fertility because of the cone that's being pointed away. When I do the tours, I like to make the link with C.S. Lewis, who presumably would have visited the Ashmolean at some point, like many undergraduates.
I would think so.
And he would have seen this human figure with the head of a bird and some wings. You'd be forgiven if you thought, I've seen that somewhere before. And you would be thinking of the figure Tash, who appeared mostly in the last battle as this body of a human, head of a bird figure, running through the forest carrying one of the wicked Calormenes. So it's possible that that had an effect on him. It's very hard to be really original in your thinking. So you quite often get inspired by some image that you've seen somewhere along the way.
For those who've just joined us, we're talking with James Gregg about the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford. You have, as I said at the opening, a tour that you give, the Bible in the Ashmolean. How did you decide to start doing something like this?
I work now as a lawyer in Oxford, and I'd been doing tours of the Bible in the British Museum for some 30 years, and I stumbled across some of these artifacts in the Ashmolean Museum. And of course, you've got to work with your local material. You can't spend the whole time saying how good the British Museum is. The items there lent themselves to a more extended tour that starts with the Old and New Testaments and then carries on all through church history because of items that have been found in the museum that relate to the spread of the Bible rather than the making of the Bible or the events taking place. I had a lot of fun weaving these articles together, managing to work in a bit of the Reformation, some of Alfred the Great's translation of Psalms into English, and a bit of world mission and the abolition of slavery. So you can work quite a few things in using the material that the Ashmoleans got. And it's mercifully a lot smaller than the British Museum, so that makes it more manageable.
Well, maybe we'll need to have a discussion about the Bible in the British Museum at another time. But you mentioned Alfred, which is part of your tour. I was fascinated to find out that 500 years before Wycliffe started translating the Bible into English, Alfred was working on some of the biblical passages.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. I'm not sure if Alfred gets covered much in American school curricula, but he is an important part of English history. He was Anglo-Saxon. He was living in a time when England was under attack from the Scandinavians, from the Vikings. In his theology, he very much saw himself as a successor king, in some ways like the Old Testament kings, who were looking after their people. So Christianity was less of a private religion and more of a state enterprise, and we are God's people and we're under attack. And he believed there was a link between the virtue of his people and the faithfulness of his people and the extent to which they might be punished by God through ravaging Danes and Vikings. He felt his people couldn't really do good or act in the correct way unless they were properly taught. And so during his lifetime, he asked for more preachers to be sent across from France, which at that point was a far more spiritual and biblical country than England was. And of course, I'm using modern terms to describe these territories. Another thing he did was he wanted his people, the Anglo-Saxon people, to be able to read the Bible for themselves in English, which was the language spoken by the Anglo-Saxons. He only got as far as translating the Psalms, But here's an example of what he wrote in his commentary on his translation of Psalm 13. Whether it was him personally or him doing it with others, we're not sure. He was something of a scholar, but this is the commentary he wrote just before his translation of Psalm 13. When David sang this 13th psalm, he lamented to the Lord that in his time there should be so little faith and so little wisdom should be found in the world. And so does every just man who sings it, that's Psalm 13, now. He laments the same thing in his own time. And so did Christ with respect to the Jews and Hezekiah with respect to the Assyrians. And Alfred saw himself very much as being in the line of a Hezekiah figure, defending his territory against, in Hezekiah's case, the Assyrians, but in Alfred's case, the Vikings.
That's fascinating history, and you're right. I don't think it's treated very well here in the U.S. That's completely new to me. Well, getting into your tour, one of the first things you talk about are fertility figurines that have been found and excavated all over Israel, and I think many museums would have figurines like this because they're so common.
It's correct. They're certainly in the British Museum, and I expect elsewhere. I think what comes to mind from them is that we tend to feel awkward in their presence. When I'm going through a gallery that is about the land of Israel and things found there, people feel very uncomfortable on my tours with these items, which are clearly nothing to do with the worship of Yahweh. We forget that the scriptures that we have are because they were written by prophets, Jeremiah, for example, and Hosea and others, because of the unfaithfulness of the people. So in some ways, it shouldn't surprise us that the majority of people in Israel were not necessarily faithful worshippers. You know, we have the ratio of 400 to 1 in the case of Elijah against the prophets of Baal or Baal. I read an interesting article by someone called Ephraim Stern in Biblical Archaeology Review about these figures. He says, for those who think they're just brought in by traders and aren't representative of basically pagan worship by people living in the land of Israel, he says the majority of these figurines found are all around the area of the temple. So they're clearly part of what people living in Jerusalem are doing. His conclusion on national attempts to follow the law faithfully, he says they were less than 100% successful. That's an understatement, but we could equally come to that conclusion by looking at what's written, the warnings given in the major and the minor prophets to do with idolatry, and could equally come to the same conclusion.
The ubiquity of those fertility figurines in ancient Israel give us a clearer understanding of what the Old Testament prophets were talking about. That's just one of the special items of note included in James Gregg's tour, The Bible in the Ashmolean Museum, at the Ashmolean in Oxford, England. We'll have some more examples of how the displays in the Ashmolean help us understand the Bible better in our next conversation. Keeping up with the latest discoveries and developments in biblical archaeology can be a challenge, but it's much easier with a subscription to Artifacts, our biblical archaeology news magazine. You can find out how to subscribe by going to our website at radioscribe.com. There we also have breaking news videos from the Israel Antiquities Authority and also information on our next trip to Israel in November 2024. That's at radioscribe.com. I'm Gordon Govier. Thanks for listening. Join us again next time for more Backgrounders on the Bible through Biblical Archaeology on The Book and the Spade.
The Book and the Spade is produced by Scribe Media. For information on biblical archaeology resources or obtaining a copy of this program on CD, go to our website at radioscribe.com.